concesiones. Subió los salarios de los trabajadores estatales y formó un comité para reformar la Constitución. Muy poco, muy tarde, dicen los egipcios, que una vez más llenaron la Plaza de la Liberación el martes. Ponen una condición no negociable encima de todas: la salida del presidente Hosni Mubarak.
El pueblo egipcio luchó durante 60 años, pero nunca ha visto un levantamiento como este. Desde la revolución de 1952, los egipcios han vivido bajo condiciones inhumanas y humillantes, y hoy es la hora del juicio final.
Los opositores de Mubarak no solo no se cansan, parecen ser cada vez más determinados y numerosos. El martes marca 2 semanas desde que el levantamiento popular se desencadenó.
El gobierno egipcio está intentando dar una imagen de que en este país todo ha vuelto a la normalidad. Pero en esta plaza la gente dice al contrario.
Cientos de miles de manifestantes acudieron a la plaza central de El Cairo. Muchos vinieron por primera vez, incluyendo personas de clase alta.
Es mi primer día aquí. Está bien. Nos pueden golpear todo lo que quieran, pero no saldremos. Esto tiene que pasar. Vamos a conseguir nuestra libertad.
Los enfrentamientos de la semana pasada ya son una memoria lejana. Ahora, la Plaza Tahrir parece una fiesta callejera, donde vienen familias enteras.
La propaganda en los medios dice que solo los hambrientos están aquí. Soy médico y mi esposo es médico. Estamos aquí para unirnos a todos los egipcios.
En un país donde hace un par de semanas fue casi imposible participar en una protesta sin ser detenido, o peor, no se olvida de los sacrificios que se hicieron para que esta movilización pudiera ser posible. Imágenes de los llamados mártires de la revolución cuelgan por todas partes de la plaza. Y los familiares de las víctimas vienen a la plaza para exigir la justicia y un cambio de gobierno.
Mi hijo trabajaba para ayudar a mis 6 hijas. Mataron a mi único hijo. Lo asesinaron a tiros en la cabeza. Que Dios le haga lo que ellos han hecho.
Al caer la noche, los manifestantes siguieron en la plaza, dejando bloqueado este puente que cruza el río Nilo. Por otra parte, miles de personas participaron en protestas en frente del Parlamento. Reed Lindsay, Telesur, El Cairo.
El subsecretario del Ejército de Estados Unidos, Joseph Westphal, después de ocupar los titulares de los diarios diciendo que los cárteles del crimen organizado en México representan un tipo de insurgencia con el potencial para llegar al gobierno, se retractó alegando que había caracterizado erróneamente el reto que representan los grupos criminales. Algunos interpretaron las palabras iniciales del militar como el presagio de más intervención norteamericana en su vecino del sur, aunque otros señalan que Washington no está diciendo todo lo que sabe. La National Drug Threat Assessment estima que los 20 millones de adictos estadounidenses cuestan a la economía del país 215 mil millones de dólares al año en costos de tribunales, cárceles y pérdida en la productividad nacional. Ese dinero es suficiente para dar seguro médico a más de 30 millones de personas. Otros apuntan a la falta de responsabilidad e hipocresía norteamericana que rehúsa reconocer sus contribuciones a la violencia en México. De acuerdo a la televisora Al Jazeera, miembros del grupo narcotraficante de los Zetas fueron entrenados en cuarteles militares estadounidenses y Edgar Valdés Villarreal, el capo conocido como La Barbie, es un tejano que desempeñaba el papel de coordinador de asesinos de capos de la droga mexicanos. Luego está el beneficio que el tráfico ofrece a la economía estadounidense. La publicación Bloomberg, en su edición del junio 29 de 2010, dice que el Banco Wachovia, ahora propiedad de Wells Fargo, admitió que entre 2004 y 2007 lavó 378.400 millones de dólares de casas de cambio de México. Según algunos cálculos, la suma equivale a una tercera parte del Producto Interno Bruto Mexicano. Bloomberg señala que Wachovia, en 2008, admitió en la corte que no se percató de una enorme cantidad de dinero en efectivo que ellos tramitaron, el mismo dinero que fue utilizado para comprar 4 aviones que después se usaron para transportar 22 toneladas de cocaína. Bloomberg reporta que entre 2002 y 2009 los agentes federales atraparon a gente de los cárteles mexicanos depositando dinero en el Banco de América en las ciudades de Atlanta, Chicago y Brownsville, Texas. Datos oficiales muestran que ningún banco mayor ha sido enjuiciado por violar las leyes contra el lavado de dinero. El Departamento de Justicia solo impone una multa a los transgresores. Los violadores pagan y prometen no volver a hacerlo. En el caso de las violaciones del Banco Wachovia, su nuevo dueño, el Banco Wells Fargo, pagó una multa de 160 millones de dólares por las faltas cometidas. Los narcodólares también han sido la medicina milagrosa para el sistema capitalista en los últimos años. Antonio María Costa, titular de la Oficina de Drogas y Crimen en Naciones Unidas, dijo al Guardián de Londres que los miles de millones de narcodólares en circulación previnieron el hundimiento del sistema financiero durante la crisis global. En la segunda mitad de 2008, dijo, la liquidez en el sistema bancario era el principal problema y por eso el capital líquido se convirtió en un factor importante. En Los Ángeles, yo soy Fernando Velázquez.
Casi un año después del ataque militar israelí a la Flotilla de la Libertad, donde murieron 9 activistas humanitarios, una coalición internacional planea nuevos intentos de llevar ayuda a 1.5 millones de palestinos en Gaza. La expedición internacional, que cuenta con la participación de activistas de 17 países, coincidirá con 2 fechas históricas. El día de la Nakba, el 15 de mayo, que conmemora el inicio de la masiva expulsión de los palestinos a raíz de la creación del Estado de Israel, y el 31 de mayo, fecha del asalto israelí a la Flotilla de la Libertad, que acabó con la vida de 9 activistas e hirió a otros 50. El objetivo de la nueva flotilla es el mismo que la vez anterior: conseguir romper el bloqueo que ejerce Israel sobre la Franja de Gaza y llevar ayuda humanitaria a la población palestina. Esta segunda flotilla de la libertad llevará el doble de barcos a la de hace un año. Esta semana en Madrid, España, en el acto de presentación de la segunda flotilla, se presentó un spot protagonizado por artistas e intelectuales españoles. Para más información se puede visitar la página web rumboagaza.org.
El pasado 31 de mayo, 9 personas fueron asesinadas por el ejército israelí cuando viajaban rumbo a Gaza en la flotilla de la libertad.
Iban 6 barcos. Más de 700 personas, 10.000 toneladas de ayuda humanitaria.
Ayuda que nunca llegó a su destino.
Truncando las esperanzas de más de 1.5 millones de palestinos que viven en Gaza.
¿Os hacéis idea de cómo se vive en Gaza?
Desde el año 2007, su población sufre un bloqueo ilegal por parte del gobierno israelí que les mantiene asfixiados, maniatados,
silenciados.
Viven en una cárcel a cielo abierto donde nadie puede entrar ni salir.
Donde el 80% de la población depende de la ayuda humanitaria.
Donde los derechos humanos son pisoteados cada minuto.
Imagínense cómo es sentirse olvidado.
Les han robado sus cultivos, les han ocupado sus tierras, les han echado de sus casas.
Pero no han logrado acabar con su dignidad. Resisten como pueden.
Ante el silencio impasible de la comunidad internacional, que no escucha, que no mira, que no condena.
Hace 2 años tuvo lugar una masacre sin precedentes.
Las bombas israelíes mataron a más de 1.400 personas. El 85% eran civiles. Más de 300 eran niños.
Y silencio.
Israel incumple las resoluciones que le impone las Naciones Unidas.
Se viola de manera sistemática la legalidad internacional.
Se está cometiendo un genocidio.
¿Y tú qué sientes?
Impotencia.
Humillación.
Olvido.
Llanto.
Indignación.
Desesperación.
Injusticia.
Dolor.
Vergüenza.
Deseo de luchar.
La próxima primavera florecerán nuevas esperanzas.
Y Y así llegamos al final de otra edición del Informativo Pacífica. Nuestro agradecimiento al colectivo Más Voces de España y a todos los medios que hicieron posible este programa. A nombre del director del proyecto, Fernando Velázquez, se despide Norma Martínez. Gracias por su atención.
Este y otros programas del Informativo Pacífica pueden ser escuchados o descargados en kpfk.org en los archivos de audio.
And welcome to Bathrop Spears Broadsides, the, February 10th, 2011 edition. I'm Robert Norris. Stay with me for the next 2 hours if you have the patience. In the studio with me is my monitor and mentor, Stephen Plaich. Stephen?
Good evening. Good evening, everyone.
And Stephen will no doubt make pungent comments now and then until I, of course, cut him off. That was Laura Nero, Stony End, from, I guess, a collection, posthumous collection, Time and Love, The Essential Masters. I like Laura Nero. I hope you do, too. What do you like, Laura Nero, Steve? What
I like her very much. Indeed, I do.
She's got a wonderful voice, great songwriter, and she's gone. But her songs are here, which is what's more important. Anyway, this is 101.1 FM, www.freakradio.org. This is Bathrobes Piers Broadsides. And with me is my occasional visitor, sometime co-host, and eternal tormentor, Stephen Plaich.
Good evening, everyone.
Who is best known for his sucking up to city council members and engaging in charitable events such as the "We'll do it once a year, so be very happy" Thanksgiving meal. Oh, wait, we'll do it again in a smaller way on Christmas.
You have agreed to my statement that I probably got more mileage out of an unsuccessful city council campaign than anyone in Santa Cruz electoral history.
And even more mileage out of your incredible presence here in the studio with me, which I am not even charging you for. This is priceless opportunity for you here in the studio. And actually, all kidding aside, Steve here is, I got to tell you, one of the most incredibly dynamic endlessly persistent, although somewhat conservative, workers I've ever seen. For example, this afternoon I gave him a task, or I should say I suggested he might want to get involved in the task. He's been doing a lot of work for the Peace Camp 2010, and perhaps you want to update people as to what's happening with that group of homeless activists who is currently being pursued by the district attorney, the city attorney. You know, in theory, I think there are at least 50 outstanding either citations, warrants, misdemeanor charges, not just, oh, dear, it was an infraction, we'll ignore it, send it south, or and get three of them, well, there'll be a misdemeanor maybe. These are real misdemeanors, and people are either going to have to, there are failure to appear warrants for at least, I don't know, it's 50 people, but it's certainly 50 charges. I think it's 50 people, actually. But well, I think it's 50 charges, actually.
I think Ed said that under the general umbrella of camping ban violations, be they ordinance or
Ed Fry, the attorney.
There were 29 of them. So those are the ones that he consolidated.
He's wrong. There are more.
Are there?
I've checked it out. But, I mean, the ones that, I mean, I went through, actually, with a whole bunch of unlikely names of people I didn't know, some of them Spanish names of people who we were not able to clearly organize under our umbrella. We had a situation where at Peace Camp 2010 throughout the month of July, there really was essentially a de facto amnesty. Actually, it wasn't really an amnesty because later on people got citations. But during that month, people came with no legal place to sleep, Monica Martinez notwithstanding, at the Homeless Service Center, and they slept in front of the county building.
Well, I think as much as anything, it was a stratagem, really, on the part of Peace Camp 2010, because it so confused the city and county authorities that they really couldn't figure out under whose authority that particular area was and whether or not there was a sleeping ban in effect on county premises. And what they had ultimately determined was that because the county building, although it actually is a county building which belongs to the state, is in the city limits, that you can enforce a camping ban. That's when they decided that they were going to start issuing tickets.
But they actually never did enforce the camping ban. They actually pulled out a state law that they could have used at the very beginning if they wanted, which they have, in fact, used in the past, though not in that location, usually up in the Poganip or elsewhere.
Maybe that was the peace campers' clever strategy, just to confuse them so much that they didn't
I think
possibly
there's
plan along.
Who knows? But, in fact, what they did do was they were able to draw all kinds of media attention to an issue which I think the authorities would prefer to be kept under the rug. That is to say, shelter space for somewhere between 1,000 and 2,000, shelter space somewhere between, 46 people in the
in the
summer, late spring and early fall, and then in the rest of the year, about 4 or 5 months, there's an additional 75 or 100 if you cram them into the armory, for 1,000 to 2,000 people. And the rest of the time, there's a sleeping ban law that makes it illegal. That's the county ordinance, which normally is not, you know, we've tried to diminish the seriousness of that ordinance by it began as an infraction. They're supposed to get two of them. You got a misdemeanor. We removed that provision in 1999 through pressure, but it was essentially restored in a certain sense in 2009 by Don Lane and Catherine Byers and Coonerty and Rotkin in a unanimous council vote that said if you get three citations of any kind and you don't attend to them, and most homeless people do not have the time, energy, or resources to attend to these citations, then you will get a new citation called a misdemeanor for not attending to them. And then they made it even worse last year in 2010 by saying if you don't attend to the three citations, any subsequent citation for any subsequent infraction will be treated as a misdemeanor. I think it's three unintended infractions within 6 months, I think, will lead to that situation. I'm not quite clear how that works out, but it has a strangely, certainly a punitive ring, an abusive ring, maybe an unconstitutional ring. Legal expert Steve Plage, what do you think?
Well, I'm not certain how many of those prosecutions have actually been brought forward. I'm sure that people are still getting tickets. I'm sure they're not attending to those tickets because, as you say, they don't have the time, energy, or resources to do so. But I couldn't tell you whether or not many of those misdemeanor charges have been filed as a result of an unattended three ordinance violation ticket. My position has always been that we should repeal the camping ban. It's a failed policy. It certainly criminalizes homelessness. I campaigned on that for 5 months during the most recent city council campaign. I still
What kind of reaction did you get in your campaign? Was it mostly negative, mostly positive, mixed?
You know what? I guess kind of a benign neglect, really. I mean, I think that the people who live in the city believe that their leaders at this point are so entrenched in terms of keeping the camping ban in force that it really doesn't matter whether there's a lone voice in the wilderness, that regardless of how strong that voice might be or how persistent it is, they're not worried about the camping ban being repealed. And so I think that there were just more bemusement than anything else, but I still wanted to say that I believe that the criminalization of homelessness is a failed policy. The camping ban should be repealed, and we're working every day to do that, and we will get there at some point.
Now, you're talking about the reaction of city council members more than... What about members of the general public?
Oh, no. What I'm talking about, we had 13 candidates for, and they were from all different interest groups in the city. Santa Cruz Neighbors, Take Back Santa Cruz, GOBT, Simba Kenyatta hosted one for the NAACP, although we didn't talk much about homelessness there. But most of the candidates for that were very well attended, either the homeless issue wasn't brought up at all by any candidate, unless I managed to kind of shoehorn into one of the questions that were asked, or there was just kind of a general, well, you're against the camping ban, okay, what are we going to talk about now? And that's really the reaction that that you get. We did have a pretty spirited meeting with Santa Cruz Neighbors toward the end of the campaign, or maybe just afterwards, that Father Joel Miller attended, that our friend Peter Lindemann attended, that several people who are Santa Cruz Neighbors attended, and homelessness was actually vigorously argued the pros and cons at that meeting.
And I know you also have been, sorry, my mic better be turned up there.
Yeah, there we go.
That'd be good. You also have been concerned, although we've been concerned, I'm sure you are, of course, also concerned with abolition of the camping ordinance.
Absolutely.
That in the meantime, interim steps have interested you, specifically the ordinance passed in this fall at the initiative of the city attorney, and I have often speculated, though Catherine Byers has denied, at the under pressure, really, from the Peace Camp 2010 protests that were resulting in literally scores of citations, even though somewhere between 30 and 50 misdemeanor tickets were issued, more than 100 infraction citations
were issued.
And those, you know, those also can clog the courts. Those also indicate a punitive attitude by the city to homeless people who are simply trying to survive. Yeah. They're not destroying property. They're not stealing things. They're not hurting people. They are simply, and they're engaged in First Amendment protests, which makes it even worse from a middle-class perspective. I mean, over in Egypt, you have people, they're going to be 10 million strong tomorrow. They hope to have this large funeral for this journalist that was killed by the Mubarak regime. Here in the United States, we would hope that everyone would have some basic right to hold up a sign at City Hall, but no, they've closed the City Hall grounds at night. You, of course, will be there with your sign at 10:05 tonight in order to challenge that ordinance. Correct, Steve?
I had thought about that. Yeah, I just can't figure out what the wording is going to be on my sign.
As soon as I resolve that, that's reasonable.
But no, give credit where credit is due. I think that the revision of the camping ban that came down during the summer was at least doing some small part, at least, as I say, of the Peace Camp 2010 demonstrations. Absolutely. I think they had some political effect on the camping ban. So, you know, as I say, give them credit because they had to do that.
I would agree, of course. I mean, although I can't prove it, I'm still looking for more conclusive evidence one way or the other. I also, however, am as skeptical, although I know you are less so, or at least you're more hopeful, let's put it that way, that this is a meaningful change. I had said it was. It seems to be on paper a meaningful change. What the new change is if you're on one of the waiting lists of the Homeless Services Center, then if you get a ticket after that point, then the ticket will be dismissed. The city attorney shall dismiss that citation, and the camping ban law shall not apply, which sounds good. The question is, how is it being used? Is that actually happening? And, you know, you've advised us, and we at HUF, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, the civil rights organization we both go to every Wednesday at 10:30 at the Abbey Cafe. More on that later.
Now actively recruiting volunteers and interns.
Indeed. Even though we're trying to get people to sign up on the waiting list with a flyer that says, therefore, theoretically, they will have their tickets dismissed, I found, at least in the very limited information I've gotten from people like activist Todd Hill, that in his attempts to sign up have not been successful. He goes over there, he says he's given a runaround, the office is suddenly closed, they're busy, come back later, blah, blah, blah. Now, I don't know, Todd is, it's not clear, I haven't heard a lot of reports one way or the other, so I'd like people to tell me, And I can be reached at 423-HUFF if you have 50 cents or a cell phone, 423-4833. Leave a message saying, I went to the Homeless Service Center to sign up for the waiting list. And remember, if you sign up, it doesn't mean you have to actually go and get your place on the waiting list. You just have to have signed up for the waiting list. And that means you have to put your name on the list. It should also be said that you also, if you want your ticket to be dismissed, you have to waive confidentiality so that if the city attorney calls in and says, who's on, you know, are A, B, C, D, E, F, and G, we got tickets for them on the waiting list. You know, are they on the waiting list? And if they are, we'll dismiss the tickets. You have to give the Homeless Service Center permission to give your name to the police in the hope that they will simply do what the city attorney apparently or the contact you have in the office has told you that it will do, which is not use it in any other way.
I mean, what strikes me about the whole situation, at least the current state of the camping ban, is that you and I went back and forth about the wording of a flyer to give people notice they were on the waiting list and they could have these tickets dismissed. And you and I both went down to the Red Church this last Monday and passed them out and then walked around town and talked to some folks about whether or not you could give them the information, try to give them as much fully informed as possible and you know, within reason. And we really couldn't find that many people who had been given camping ban tickets recently. So I'm just wondering what's happening with that. Is that just anecdotal? We just didn't talk to the right people? Are they still issuing tons of camping ban tickets? Are we just missing those people? Well, you keep hearing about them, but you don't keep hearing about them from people who are getting them.
No, I do.
And that's the thing.
I have. I mean, I'll interview people and they say, I got a camping ticket 3 nights ago or something like that. I mean, I've heard, I would say, in the last 2 months of, I don't know, about a dozen tickets.
A dozen tickets. So we have, 1,500 to 2,000, by your estimation, unsheltered people sleeping out every night. And out of those 3 weeks and 21 nights, multiply that by how many people you're sleeping out, and we got 12 tickets?
Well, I didn't say that. Obviously, I don't talk to all the people.
I mean,
but I mean,
you know,
more important than that, I mean, I have acknowledged that every month, if you look at the city's own figures, it's like 60 to 90 tickets a month. That's been the previous figure.
So they're giving an average of 3 tickets a night to the 2,000 unsheltered people who are sleeping
outdoors. Correct, but that doesn't mean the rest of the people sleep safely or comfortably.
No, I'm not saying that
right,
at all.
Right.
But I'm saying that's their pattern of enforcement, so it's at least notable.
No, I don't deny it, and that's what we call a reluctant admission, because we're trying to end the ban, but we don't want to do so, however, with the facts. We're not going to exaggerate the impact. But I think there is a very significant impact in terms of the ability of people to sleep safely in groups, the ability of women and vulnerable elderly people or young people to have, you know, the comfort of other people nearby, the ability to have access to emergency services. If you have somebody with you, it's more likely you'll be able to get help if you're overdosing or sick or something to that effect.
Yeah, and that's the one thing, frankly, that for all the talk from Santa Cruz Neighbors and a lot of the various neighborhood groups.
Take Back
about,
Santa Cruz, for
about we're a homeless mecca, and one of the reasons that we are, notwithstanding the fact that we have 300 days of sunshine every year, we have all these wonderful homeless services, but when you talk to people in San Francisco that have truly comprehensive homeless services for people that can transition from a hospital stay into a shelter bed, perhaps, or from some problem they have, but they would actually have some help in transitioning from the problem of their experience to at least be directed toward a shelter bed. Here in Santa Cruz, that's not the case. I don't know whether I've told you this, Robert, but I do a lot of work, as you know, with Save Our Shores, and we did a river cleanup under the Felker Street Bridge a week ago Saturday. So it started at 10. I'm out there about 9:30 kind of getting ready, and I saw this woman kind of walk up, and she's in kind of hospital blue gown without her shoes. And she was a homeless person who had just been released from the hospital and didn't have her shoes, and here she has no transitional support whatsoever from the homeless services in Santa Cruz, and that's the kind of thing. That's the kind of gap in services that really should be highlighted, not having people say, oh, our service is so wonderful, that's why we're attracting all these homeless folks. It just simply is not true. We have adequate homeless services superficially, but certainly not enough to deal with the problems that the homeless community has here in Santa Cruz. And that's another thing that we should be concentrating on.
Yeah, I would certainly agree with you, except for the part about San Francisco having adequate or significantly better services for the average homeless person.
We just talked to the guy the other night, and he was giving us a whole range of services
right.
They have that we don't.
They also have a population that is, 20 times our population.
No, that is not true.
Well, there are 750,000, 800,000 people in San Francisco, right?
Their homeless population on their surveys is about 4,000. Now if that's underestimated by
way
two, that's 8,000. So that's
13,000 according to the Coalition on Homelessness.
And that's 20 times what we have here, three or four. Now, at least be accurate in what you're saying.
I'm thinking of the. I wasn't saying the homeless population. I was talking about the population of the city.
You were implying it was a homeless population. That's just not right.
Well, no.
So don't make outlandish statements. Well, that's not right because they've got 20 times the homeless population. Well, they don't.
I'm not trying to be outlandish.
And they don't
I'm
have
more
20
of an
times. They
don't
have
guy,
20 times our physical population either.
Because all right,
we're talking
all right,
about, 15 we're talking
times,
about San Francisco
15 times
City and
the
County
population.
And Santa Cruz County.
How about 15 times? That's
no, they're not, because Santa Cruz County has 260,000 people.
We're not talking about Santa Cruz County.
Yes, you are, because
no.
every time you talk about homeless people,
no.
we're talking about the number
no.
of people in Santa
no, I'm
Cruz
not.
County.
You may be, but I'm not. I'm talking about the city's homeless, because the city is the area that has the sleeping ordinance that I'm really concerned about, 6.36010A and A and B, not to mention
well,
C.
You're just overstating the facts, and shouldn't be doing that.
I think we're talking about...
You should be more careful with the facts.
No, I think we're talking about apples and oranges. I think the county actually has a much larger homeless population.
You can't
population
separate than out here because San Francisco is a city and a
hang
county.
Hang on a second. It has a much larger homeless population than you estimate. For example, in 1988, Department of Social Services estimated it was 8,000 to 10,000. In 1988, now we're in 2011, I think it's probably increased rather than decreased, though it's hard to say.
Isn't that what the fellow you interviewed 2 weeks ago said?
You mean the woman I interviewed?
Bob, Robert, who was the homeless...
Okay, no, Bob doesn't know anything about our Santa Cruz homeless population.
He knows about San Francisco,
right,
and I asked him what their population was.
No,
and
no,
I told
Steve,
him that I believe
Steve, I was talking about the Santa Cruz County homeless population a moment ago. You're not following what I'm saying.
Well,
you're getting all passionate here, Steve, and I appreciate
because
good
you're misstating the facts as usual.
No,
you can't let this pass.
No, I
you
think
know, at least
and I appreciate your passion
facts.
For facts, but again, there are three different populations we're talking about. But let's agree that we have differing estimates of the number of homeless in the city, the county, and in San Francisco. Let's agree with that.
Well, and what's your opinion of the comparative homeless services offered by the city and county of San Francisco and the city of Santa Cruz?
As I told you before, I don't think the comparatively speaking, the resources up there are better for the average homeless person. And I think
that's exactly what I said.
Right. Well, then we agree.
Yeah. Okay.
Because you initially began by saying that look what San Francisco has, all these transitional services, look at all these things they have.
Because they do. And
they
have the very models that we should be following.
Right, but for the average homeless person, I don't think they're in a much better shape than we are. And that's not to praise us. That's simply to be accurate about San Francisco, based on what the San
Francisco. I'm trying to give people a more realistic.
Based on what the San Francisco homeless advocates have been telling me for the last 20 years. Now they're biased. I mean, obviously they're advocates for the homeless like we are, and so they may be putting it in a particular light. So I acknowledge that. Anyway, I think it would be good if we had more services. I think that some of the things San Francisco does are probably better
saying,
than what we do.
And certainly everybody's going to agree that you want to have more and better services. What I'm saying is that the. Yeah. The general population's conception of what our service, their perception of what our services is not accurate because they think we have all these wonderful services,
right, course,
you know, and we clearly do not.
No disagreement. Yeah. No disagreement. Let's turn to some of the interviews of the actual human beings that we are treating as straw, Megan and women and figure and you know abstract figures. Actually, let's look at some of the voices on the street. And I believe this is from December 31st. I'm going to be beginning the tape. Then we're going to leap ahead into February. But
December 31st of this last year.
Of this last year, not 3 years ago. No, that we could go back
or 10 or 20.
We've done that in the past. Yeah, we do have flashbacks on the show, but we're not flashing back right now. Sometimes I have flashbacks even when I'm not on the show. But that's another story. All right. By the way, if people want to call in and because you can't understand because we're interrupting each other far too frequently, please give a call to 423-4833 and complain. Or you can interrupt us yourself. We can all start interrupting each other. It'll be a lot of fun. Again, I'm sorry. That's the wrong number. I even gave you the wrong number. 427-3772. 427-3772 is the call-in number. That other number I gave you is actually the off-air number in case you want to swear at me off-air. So, again, 427-FRSC. I also want to announce that at 7 o'clock we're expecting a call from Berkeley from, what is that man's name? Dan, who's been researching and actually he's a disabled guy. He's with a disabled group up there. And he's also an advocate for public spaces and the famous People's Park, which is at Telegraph and Bancroft.
Did they ever go up and
Telegraph
do any tree sitting up there? As they had,
there was a tree sitting. In fact, some of the recent controversy around the whole issue up there of People's Park has involved a tree sit, which was disrupted by Well, it depends on who you believe, but according to the advocates that I tend to give credibility to, the police sort of encouraged a couple of drunks to climb up in the tree and demand the tree sitters come down. And the tree sitter defended himself when they were going to pull. They're talking about burning down the tree,
and he was a little nervous
about that. We'll hear from Dan McMillan.
Yeah, I was just asking that because, as our audience probably well knows, we had the mother of all tree sitting protests here at UCSC.
We had one of them. Certainly, maybe we call it the grandchild of all, because they certainly have a lot of tree sitting up in other counties that have been much more lengthy and prolonged than ours. But still, that was last year, and I know that we're having. I guess there's going to be some. Not so much of tree sits, but of upcoming protests by students on the campus. I guess it's more about issues of, you know, economic issues like huge raises in tuition.
And you yourself will be tree sitting in a small spruce out in front of the studio later this evening?
I will be observing closely these events and interviewing people around that issue as they tumble down into the hands of the police. Hopefully not. Actually, no, the students aren't going to be tree sitting next Wednesday. They're going to be talking on John Malkin's show, The Great Leap Forward. He's going to be having interviews with students who are going to be doing some protests or have already done some protests or who will do some. I'm not sure quite what it's all about, but keep tuned for the Great Leap Forward. If you want to get more information about free radio, you should check out Free Radio Santa Cruz online. Go to www.freakradio.org, which is where you are now, because unfortunately, as some of you may know, we're not broadcasting on the air at the moment. It's unfortunate we're having some problems with the equipment, but we are going out.
We're streaming, right?
We are streaming. Okay. Correct. Well put. All right, let's hear some other voices. It's about time, and then you'll hear some more of us. And maybe if you call in from the stream or just for the heck of it, we'll hear from you.
Now, here we have a man in the Christmas spirit with a sign that says, "Ladies, I'll kiss your butt for a buck. Guys, no way." And you have a naughty Santa hat on. Your name, sir?
Yeah, Brian went to Lloyd's.
Lloyd's?
Yeah.
And we'll pause briefly while a little colloquy is going on here on the sidewalk. And we'll see if we can get a little information on why our Santa here is sitting next to the... Actually, it's next to the parking garage on Soquel Street across from the New Leaf Market, right under a Do Not Enter sign. But it may take too long. We'll see if we can actually do it. So, Naughty Santa, what are you doing out here on New Year's Eve?
I'm trying to get money together so I can get a tent and some sleeping bags.
Now, how long have you been outside?
Going on 2 years.
And have you previously had a tent and a sleeping bag which somehow disappeared, or what happened there?
Yeah, I did.
And
I had a 10-man tent that I lost the poles to, and I had two of the big 30-degree down sleeping bags. I lost it all because of the cops.
Tell me more about how the police were involved.
They took me to jail for carrying a 12-in-1 tool.
What is a 12-in-1 tool?
A Leatherman.
That's a knife, or you're looking in your bag here to show me an item, perhaps a vividly described, of course, we aren't on television, but...
A 12-in-1 tool.
A 12-in-1 tool, so it includes a number of items.
Yeah, pliers, screwdrivers, bottle top opener, all that.
And are you on parole or probation that bans you from doing this?
I'm not allowed to carry a blade longer than 2 inches.
How long is the blade on the 12-in-1?
Cutting surface is a little less than 2 inches, but they measure from the tip to the hilt.
Did you get a conviction for this or a parole violation?
Parole violation. I've had four of them.
And you use this for attacking savagely the citizenry or for other purposes?
I use it for different things, like cutting up my cardboard or any number of things, working on bikes if I have to work on a bike.
Are you pretty much around Santa Cruz, or have you spent most of your time elsewhere?
Most of my time elsewhere. I've only been in Santa Cruz for about a little over a week and a half.
And how is it treating you?
Like shit.
In terms of like financial donations or everything else?
As well as financial donations.
So you haven't been hassled by the police, or have you?
I have. They've first alarm comes and wakes me up when I fell asleep behind the bank or anywhere else. I got kicked off the beach and So now I went and found another place to sleep, and the cops just drive right by, so it's kind of hard to see me in the dark.
So you have been sleeping illegally in Santa Cruz?
Who doesn't sleep illegally in Santa Cruz? When you're homeless, where else are you going to sleep? Shelters only have so many beds, and they're losing funding every month for them.
Now, are you trying to get into shelter? Have you gotten on the waiting list?
I'm trying to get a job. I've actually been outsourced by Mexicans in two different jobs. So, because when I got out of prison, I was pouring concrete for $37.50 an hour. And then after I lost that one, I started working for a roofing contractor, and the Mexican said that he'd do it for $7.50, and I was only doing it for $9. So the roofing contractor picked him up over me.
Any Mexican friends?
Acquaintances.
Anything you want to say to the folks out there in free radio land?
Party hardy, rock and roll, drink a keg, smoke a bowl.
It's a New Year's Eve. Greetings from?
John.
Thank you, John. All right, so we're down here on Pacific Avenue between one art display and another. My goodness.
Oh, yeah, this guy. Oh, yeah, I know you.
You remember me. We'll be right with you, Baltimore. Hang on.
What's this? Now I make my living.
This is a man explaining his art display.
Well, I give them away, and then I let people leave something in the hat if they want to. And more often than not, they do, so that's how I make my living.
Is it really?
Yeah.
You make these?
Yeah.
Ah.
These are a series of beautiful artistic kind of figures, and there's a free-falling dog with artistic shavings is one of the. These are artist free donations gladly accepted. And again,
yeah, you know it.
We've talked, and we have a local skateboarder. What's your name, sir? Come on over.
Hello, my name is Chad.
And you are?
Taylor.
And how are you two doing downtown tonight?
We're
very
doing
well.
Very well.
No hassles from police?
No,
yeah, we
fuck the police.
Fuck the po, though.
So, now, have you been approached by any police officers giving you trouble?
Like,
yes,
man.
I have.
And when did that happen?
Earlier today, around 5 o'clock.
We were skateboarding, they asked us to get off, and I was like, fuck you.
Yeah. That's not what you said to them.
Yeah, I did.
No, you did not. I don't believe
it. We have a witness who contradicts. What do you say?
No, I just don't believe that someone would say such a thing that a good officer of our law enforcement department.
Our police department would never be said that sort of thing. So have you guys gotten any citations or just warnings to get
warnings?
Just warnings.
And are you... anything else you want to say?
That's
for
good.
Free
they
radio?
Know that. They know that.
No, we're good in the hood.
And we've been talking with?
Eastside or Loke.
And
Eastside of Loke.
And,
you know, the local freak off the leash.
There you go. Freak off the leash, so to speak.
City Place City Council.
And, of course, the passing Steve Pledge. Inevitable and endless Steve Pledge.
Those folks in 5 years are going to be voting for me.
Somebody's got to do something about this man. I don't know what we can do. There's no way to shut him up.
You were supposed to
wind him up.
Down there, and all I found was three police officers.
Well, they were supposed to tell you, you know, that I was detained.
You were detained?
Not in that sense, no.
Yeah.
Baltimore here has a story. I'll be right with you, Steve.
Okay.
So Baltimore...
There's a whole bunch of stories.
Now, Baltimore, you're a fearsome sight with horns and mask and a drunken demeanor, but...
Because they just released me again from the drunk tank, even though I got turned myself in the 10th of January. They won't give me a break. I'm tired of harassment. I want to suck this. I'm making fucking kick ass.
So how long were you in the drunk tank this time?
17 hours.
And are you intoxicated now?
No, I'm not.
Okay, I'll
accept
that.
My liver and kidney functions will not allow me to be drunk.
Now, you said you got a ticket for a mask earlier.
He just gave me a ticket for the homeboys, man.
Now, who gave you a ticket and when?
Klein.
Officer Klein, and when did this happen?
About 15 minutes ago, right here on the corner in front of Borders.
And what did he say to you when he gave you this?
He told me, Baltimore, you get this ticket, he poured a jug out, it wasn't even in my hand.
So it was an open container ticket.
Yeah, but it wasn't mine.
I see. Now, who...
He took it from another guy and gave me the ticket, so I signed the box.
So, in other words, did he give you the container as well, that you could have at least a sip of New Year's cheer?
No, he threw it in the trash can right there.
I see. What about this mask thing you were telling me about? You're showing me this black mask.
I'm trying to pull off what I'm doing the ultimate most from Baltimore. I'm going from trying to pin the Oxycontin and getting her done. Right now I'm on a $3,000 mark in a motel to write songs. And I'm going right there to Catalyst every Tuesday night, shoot pool for free, and play moon.
So you're a singer?
No, I'm a drummer for real, and a pianist, and a...
Well, I'm not much of a musician myself.
No, you're not. You're just beautiful.
Well, thank you.
Look at my new hat.
Yeah. Anything else, Baltimore, before I leave you?
Yeah, I'd like to say to the world, man, I got to tell myself in June 10th, Baltimore won't be back on the streets, but I'll tell you what, all your reply and all your help will be appreciated.
Thank you, Baltimore.
I love you, Robert.
Thank you.
Oh, thank God.
Thank you, Baltimore. Dreamcatcher, anything you want to say? Or?
I'm going to go get my bicycle.
Play.
Play?
Play.
Oh, I'll have a chance to play.
You're beautiful.
But tonight, it's prank time. I have a prank if you want to record it. I'll go get my bike and put on my mask. And I'm going to...
I mean, is it visual or is it audio?
It's visual and audio, because I'm going to make a lot of noise. And
if you want.
I'm going to drag a big old dragon tail down this boulevard and make it look like I'm going to break out windows and get... Surprise!
Oh, dear. Well, you might get a large reaction from the actual police chief himself was at the end of the mall.
Baltimore again, I might add. It's New Year's Eve, and the cops told me if I don't get all Pacific, they're going to lock me up. So I thumbs up my neck.
Thank you, Baltimore.
No, because they're coming after me.
I hear you.
Some fuckers, look, he just took a picture of it. And baby, I ain't left over.
And actually, I will interrupt this somewhat hard to decipher colloquy because, frankly, I think we've actually played it before, and I know that people are really dying to hear it again, but I've kind of had enough. I'm going to take a musical break. Steve Plaich is going to sing one of his versions of Oh, Susanna. Actually, no, he's not. He's nodding in a friendly manner, but we're instead going to do a little more Laura Nero, and then I'll be right back with more from Bathroom Spears Broadsides, the streaming edition. Also, again, call in number 427-3772. And again, coming up in about 25 minutes, the Berkeley Report. Sorry about that. Stay tuned. And that's, of course, it's going to take a miracle. Laura Nero, Steve, you were examining the album cover, wondering if Laura is still with us. I don't think so. I was going to kind of go online and see when she died. I think she's been gone for a while. But her voice, as I said before, it's still with us, and that's sweet, you know, really sweet stuff. Your mic was down for some reason.
Imagine that. Yes,
what can I say?
No, you're pointing out that this is a compilation from 30, 35 years ago or so. So
yeah, it's some of the big hits from 35 years ago that she was doing.
Was this the laptop that was on hiatus for a couple of days?
No. This laptop is a very loyal laptop. Okay, we don't want to get into that this time.
Okay.
I have a lap, and we won't get into that either.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, looking up the life of Laura Nero, we find at her official home page, she has posthumous releases, so that must mean no longer with us. She died in 1997, according to this.
Wow.
She was born in 1947, which is the same year
I was
born.
I'll be doggone.
She died pretty young, it sounds
like. Yes, indeed. Yeah.
Well, next up on my cavalcade of stars here, having heard Baltimore and Dreamcatcher and a number of other sometimes somewhat unintelligible and other times uninteresting individuals, we have Linda LeMaster, who actually is quite articulate, usually quite interesting, and particularly relevant to us because, well, she's doing the kind of standing up for homeless people that very few people in houses do. She's not just, you know, bringing cookies or writing reports or doing little tapes that they play on the radio, but she's out there getting busted with them. And she is one of the few, in fact, I think other than Ed Fry, she's the only person who is housed who is going to court facing up to 6 months in jail and $1,000 fine for the 647E illegal lodging charge.
And recently speaking out at UCSC, where she was invited to speak.
Yesterday, last night, she spoke at UCSC, actually invited by the vice mayor and the former mayor, Mike Rotkin. I'm not sure he invited her. He was invited. We haven't yet got the report. It was a class she spoke at. It wasn't a large gathering of 2 million people in Liberation Square, which is yet to happen here in Santa Cruz, unfortunately, or in the United States anywhere. But anyway, she spoke to me and the corridors of the courtroom about a week ago, or maybe it was 2 weeks ago. It was last Friday or the Friday before, where I guess it was two Fridays ago, where Ed Fry was. We were waiting for his, his appeal. He was trying to do a demurrer to the 647E charge. I think that was it, and we had to wait throughout
that
the entire
for the
luncheon
peace
time.
Camp six,
it was for the other six people. Linda's in a separate group, and she's not being defended by Ed Fry. She's being defended by a public defender who appears to be either indifferent or incompetent. His name is Mark Garver. And Mark, if you can hear me, please call in and contradict me if you will, because I'd love to be contradicted. But you don't seem to return calls either to attorney Ed Fry, to myself, or to your client, Linda LeMaster. It is true that Mr. Garver was reportedly ill a couple weeks ago, or when this came up.
We'd also love to read the demurrer that was prepared.
The imaginary demurrer, yes. We found I spoke with attorney Ed Fry today because Garver, the public defender or public pretender, as some call them, for Linda LeMaster, is supposed to be preparing a demurrer, which means a statement that the charges against her are improperly formed and don't constitute a real crime. And so Ed, industrious man that he is, checked the file and found nary a sign of the demurrer, which is, Steve, have you ever prepared a demurrer yourself?
I have many times, yeah.
So you actually, for those who don't know, what's your legal background?
I'm a law school graduate. I was actually valedictorian in my law school class, and I worked as a research lawyer, at least that was my title, in a criminal defense firm in San Jose for about 10 years. What I did basically was do all the research and writing, wrote all their motions, writs, appeals, opinion letters, any written legal opinion that was produced by the office was my responsibility.
Can you prove it?
Yeah.
Got your diploma with you.
I heard
about the Great Pretender.
I always carry that with me just for these situations.
I've never seen it, folks.
I talked to Ed about that when the absence of the demur in the file, and I said, well, it's strange because normally when a file is sent up to the judge's chambers prior to a hearing, it's reviewed by their clerk, and the clerk always looks in the file and sees kind of what's in the file and points out relevant documents to the judge so she doesn't have to paw through it in this case. So it's unusual that while they had the file there for Linda's case, which was continued because her attorney was ill,
that was last
that they
Friday,
wouldn't have noticed that, there isn't any paperwork in here having anything to do with the demur. So I find that strange that Ed was speculating that it may have been a different file and that file contains the demur. But we don't know. It's a mystery.
It is a mystery, as has been said of many things. We're actually going back a week before Linda's case to the Santa Cruz 6 case, where Linda was talking about her case, and that's where we're going to join her in the hallway of the corridors. The hallways of the courts of justice, where the only justice is in the hallways, as they say.
Here that you're aware of, but the rest of our audience is not. But let us move on to the next point. Is there anything you want to say about anything more about this issue? Are you going to be a part of this homeless census?
I don't know. I have to go to an orientation, just like the people that didn't help invent the questionnaire. And it's at fixed times, and I'm underfunded in the kind of end-of-month way that people like me get. So I don't even know if I'll qualify, but if I'm energized enough to keep on my feet that long, I'd like to. I called Becky and other people too, hoping somebody that I know.
Becky Johnson, the homeless activist and writer.
Well, it's actually
in
the paper. She's an activist.
She is
that headline
in the this week's City on the Hill Press story is about her being convicted, I might add, and having her appeal denied for singing subversive songs outside the bookshop Santa Cruz and disturbing a working resident who was just trying to catch a few winks during the day.
Winks?
Yes.
I called her a writer and Huff activist when I wrote something about her so-called appeal last week. But some people say, what makes her an activist? So maybe you could open that up and people could figure that out together. Anyway, so I don't know if I can do this, but one of these years I'm going to be able to.
Now, I notice that we have a new, this is sort of by the by, but since we're standing here outside Department 2 or leaning against one of these tables, that, you know, the whole configuration of the court corridor has been changed. Normally, you would walk through the highly expensive and rather invasive metal detector, taking everything out of your pockets, removing all your keys, possibly taking off your belt, taking off your iron underwear, whatever you've got. And that was the old process. Now we have a process by which they put in they've reconfigured the machine so that you have to walk. You come into the building, you walk through the machine, and you don't get direct access to Departments 1 and 2. You walk all the way around the entire building, the interior building. And then when you get here, I guess you can walk out the exit directly, but there is a man in a brown outfit, dare we call him a brown shirt, with a badge and a gun.
More of a khaki, greenish brown.
It is. It's kind of an industry, a green.
And we're going to interrupt this briefly because I've been challenged off air by Steve Plage in a sarcastic manner. He wonders about the relevance of these particular descriptions of the new courtroom, walk all the way around to get to Departments 1 and 2, past the various monitoring devices. And it is true. I want to give a concession, first of all. The reason that there is this long path is because the security system in the courts is expanding from its machine that you normally walk through to in a whole new room that they are setting up that you will now be walking into, supposedly for your convenience. Actually, it's to my view, it's part of this mythology of the war on terror, the war on drugs, the idea of ramping up the fear and the notion and the paranoia that people need to be abandoning their privacy in order to get more security. whether it's at the airports or at the courthouses. The actual number of real threats to either judges or defendants, I think, is very limited and very small. It happens occasionally, but it happens everywhere anyway, as far as I can see. And I don't think it's in any way justified. Well, Steve Plage, go ahead. You try to get a word in edgewise. No, Steve. You, no, forget it. No.
That's a point
right,
well taken, but it has nothing to do with why they're having people walk around and whether or not that's either relevant to the discussion or even interesting. It seems neither.
We can discuss this for some time, but that might even be more irrelevant and less interesting. However, at the time, perhaps somebody can join in this irrelevant discussion.
Yeah,
but the reason this actually happened was because it looked to me like an additional encumbrance on the public, and I thought the encumbrance, whether for whatever purpose, sucked, and also added to the illusion of that we need to engage in more police state activity, or collude with it. Hi, you're on Free Radio with Steve and Robert. Hello, can you hear me?
Your mic up?
Yeah, I got the mic up here. Let's see. Can you hear me? Hello, hello. Hang on a second. Let's try this. Can you hear me? Hello. Okay, I'm on the phone now, but you can't. Who's calling? Hey, Dan. Let me try again to see if I can get you on the phone. Don't stay there. Can you hear me, Dan? Hello. Oh boy. Well, Dan, it looks like we may be screwed again. Try the other line, 831-469-3119. Dan, try the other line, 469-3119. Hopefully we'll be more successful on his second attempt. I think...
Is that someone who was, you were planning or expecting
that was
to call?
My interview person who's calling a little early.
Oh, good. Okay.
And we'll see. Let's try the other line. Let's see if we actually can get in on here. That wouldn't be exciting. Hello, can you hear me?
Hello.
Hey.
All right. It's unusual because this line usually doesn't work and the other line does, but this one does. So that's good.
Beautiful.
So we're talking to Dan McMillan of Berkeley. Dan, what is your official or unofficial position up there?
Well, I'm a director of Disabled People Outside Project. I work with homeless people that are disabled, which is just about everybody.
Well, I know that we've talked before about police abuse in People's Park and how you were in a wheelchair and you got assaulted by cops, 3 or 4 years ago?
Yeah, a few years ago.
And this has to do with that kind of a, does this have to do with the defense of the park, or the police just don't like wheelchairs, or you don't like police? What's the story here?
No, it was actually, we were having, we're going through this thing where they were tearing down the free box, the free boxes where the people put clothes to donate to people that need clothes, and it's been in the park since the 70s, and it got burned down by some drunken frat house kids one night, and we waited a couple weeks until we could build a really nice one out of steel, and we put that in there, and they sawed it, they tore it out of the ground, and then we built like 7 or 8 different, hold on, let me shut that off. 7 or 8 different free boxes, and they kept tearing them out, and then they put some sawhorses across the park, and I was going through the park, and I had one of my, I have 2 boys, one's, they're 8 and 10 now, but back then they were like 6 and 8 or something like that, and one of my kids jumped off my lap and kicked the sawhorse down, and then the police came up and wanted to write me a ticket for knocking over the little sawhorse that had a sign on it, and we start arguing, and the guy spit in my face, and just like talking in my face, all the spittle was coming out of his face, and I went to stand up, and they jumped on me and beat the crap out of me.
And were you hospitalized after that?
Absolutely.
What kind of injuries did you suffer?
Mostly just superficial wounds on my back and arms, and I was bleeding internally in my stomach.
And have you recovered from those injuries?
Yeah, pretty much.
And, of course, you sued the police department for $1 million.
No. When the police beat you up, you get all these charges. So, I get put in the hospital, but after I got out of the hospital, I was arrested for assault on the police and battery with, all kinds of craziness.
Dan, Steve Plage, how you doing?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing well. So how is your relationship now with the, in present day, with the Berkeley Police Department? Any better or any worse?
Well, you know, they don't want to bother with me too much because I just cause them too much paperwork and headaches and news stories and the like. But they've been doing some crazy stuff. When I'm not looking, they do crazy things to other people.
Uh-huh.
You know, they've had a tree sit in the park for like 3 months. And last week, some crazy person, drunk person, went up in the tree and attacked the tree sitter. And then I guess he used a knife to try to get the guy away from him, which was kind of stupid, but that's how it happened. And so they end up arresting the tree sitter for assault with a deadly weapon. And then the same guy who attacked the tree sitter was arrested again for attacking somebody in the park, like, yesterday. So, you know, there's some crazy person that's going around attacking people. And one guy that was, you know, trying to bring attention to the thousands and thousands of trees that UC Berkeley is planning on cutting down in the next year is the one doing all the time.
Right,
jail.
Yeah.
So there's also some issues, Dan, about, I guess, a recent small but publicized protest in the Berkeley Daily Planet, which I was reading about. You want to tell us about that?
Oh, with Michael Delacour?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, he was... He had a little protest. I was supposed to go out. I didn't make it, though. But he had a protest in front of Moe's Books. You know, it's kind of crazy because, like, Moe's Books and the Med across the street, the guy that owns the Med is, like, the most anti-homeless person. He's always about, you know, getting rid of People's Park and sweeping the homeless people off the sidewalks. And he's the head of the Homeless Commission in Berkeley. I mean, things are just crazy.
The Med owner, who you say is anti-homeless, is the head of the Homeless Commission?
Yeah.
Interesting.
And so Mike Delacour is trying to bring attention to, you know, to that. And, you know, Moe's daughter, I can't remember her name, I'm sorry, Anne, I think? Anne Moskowitz?
I'm actually looking at the story. Moe Moskowitz, of course, is Moe's name. And
right. I'm not sure what her first name is, but she is really she's really hardcore against
Doris,
you know,
Doris Moskowitz.
Doris, I'm sorry, yeah. That's right. Doris is like, you know, a really hardcore against anybody. I mean, street people that sell on the streets, that have, you know, legitimate stands on the streets, and you know, homeless people that are just, you know. She's pretty hardcore against anyone that doesn't look right on Telegraph. And you know, it's just a big, we want to start bringing attention to the people that are, you know, that are actually calling for these aggressive moves by the police. You know, not just the police themselves, you know, most of the time they just get an order. But where these orders come from is when these people, these merchants, you know, call and complain about certain types of people that they want to get rid of on Telegraph, and then the police get called out to get rid of them.
Yeah, Steve was just saying to me that this sounds rather familiar. Let me give you some earphones, Steve, so you can actually hear this.
Yeah.
You know, we have a similar situation in Santa Cruz where the Downtown Association has empowered the police. They've actually helped to fund police positions. They pressed for additional police officers after the window-breaking incident of last May when a bunch of masked people broke some windows late at night along Pacific Avenue.
Right.
And, you know, they also have been responsible for helping to fund a first alarm security guard.
Absolutely,
for a couple,
yeah,
months.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, there's the HOSTS, so-called HOSTS program in Santa Cruz. Again,
we got that, too. That's interesting.
What do they call them in your city?
Well, we call them the ghosts, because they're never around when you need them.
The ghosts. I call them the pests, or the hostility squad. They call themselves the hospitality squad.
Well, you know, they don't even talk to anybody in Berkeley. They just walk around, and they don't even do anything except for give a $60,000 salary to the guy that runs the Telegraph Association. It's a full benefits.
That would be Berkeley's Chip, probably.
Yeah, exactly.
Chip is the name of our sort of former musician, now sort of the fluff man who manages or who heads the Downtown Association. Executive director, I think, is his title.
Well, it's a fake program. Here they have this fake program called Options, which is really used to put people in jail and in and out of jail. They just keep, you know, putting them in jail. When they get out, they harass them and test them, and if they have any kind of alcohol or anything in their system, they put them back in jail until, like, somebody murders them, some killer in there murders them, and which has happened a couple of times, and one time recently with Kevin Freeman a few years back.
I remember that from the Street Spirit articles.
Yeah, and who was a really mellow person and a good friend of mine who I really liked, and I felt, and I really went crazy after that for a while. But so this Options program, they take the people, the pets and Options, and they put, and they give them these host jobs, and then this guy Roland Peterson, that's running this Telegraph Association, is grabbing, you know, $200,000-$300,000 a year from the city when we're broke, you know, to line his pockets and pay peanuts to a couple of kids to run around in these brown shirts of all things, and you know, so.
You should take our outfits. We got these nice bumblebee outfits or yellow jackets. We have these yellow and black outfits. Steve has a point, though.
Amazing. You know, it's funny. You know, back when Bob Sparks was alive, I used to come down to Santa Cruz with him a lot, and we used to always laugh at how similar the two cities are and how they come up with these things completely. You think that, I don't know if it's just because people travel back and forth so much, and they go, "Hey, we got a host program in Berkeley. You should try it in Santa Cruz," or vice versa. But we always end up with the same crap doesn't work.
Well, I think they're think tanks, you know. I mean, Berkeley was the first city to propose in California the sitting ban in 1994. And then you were successful with all your activism in throwing it onto the ballot and almost defeating it. And then Santa Cruz became the first city in California to actually pass a sitting ban under Mayor Neil Coonerty back in 1994. I'm sorry, Mayor Scott Kennedy. Coonerty was on the council, but he wasn't mayor.
Sheesh. Yeah, so, you know, last May I had a little tent city going over on a traffic island here in Berkeley for 30 days for the cuts to IHSS.
Now, what is this again? Tell me.
It was called Arnieville.
Oh, you had an Arnie, but based on what, Arnie Schwarzenegger?
Yeah.
Are you now a Brownville, or are you just brown-nosing? What's going on?
Well, I'll tell you right now, at the time...
He was the governor.
You know, people were like saying, if we can only hold out until Governor Brown becomes governor, we'll be okay.
Who said that, man?
You know, a bunch of silly, deluded people that think Democrats actually do something
Obamatons, nice to people. In other words.
And so Brown comes in office, and he wants to cut... Schwarzenegger cut IHSS by 3.6%.
IHSS, for those who don't know, is...
You know, supportive services.
And that particularly impacts disabled people, right?
Right, disabled people and the elderly.
Uh-huh.
And so now Brown wants to cut it by like 9% more, which would be like 12%, and take people that have like family members working for them and throw them off the rolls completely. If you live with somebody, it doesn't even have to be a family member. If you are disabled and you live with somebody, then you don't get anybody to take care of your needs. You know, it's just crazy, this draconian crap that's going on. And, you know, a couple years back, they bailed out these banks. And with, you know, what I see now is what it was is just a stopgap. Say, hey, how can we move this big, giant mistake of the rich onto the poor? And that's what's going on. You know, they just shifted the entire pain of all that money that was robbed onto the poor.
Well, you know, Dan,
and the services.
No, wait a minute. Now, if the Egyptian people can take this kind of neoliberal treatment in order for the good of the country, so that the banks' books can be balanced, why can't you Berkeley poor people kind of fall up in line as well?
I'm embarrassed for my country when I look at places like Egypt and where's the other place?
Tunisia.
Yeah. I look at places like that and I see how brave those people are and the courage that they have to stand up for democracy and for what's right for all people, and it embarrasses me even embarrasses me personally myself.
Hey, Dan, let me ask you this. You had a chance to observe Jerry Brown because he was the mayor of your neighboring Oakland there. What was his record in social services and the homeless when he was mayor of Oakland?
You know, it's funny you should ask. I've actually, Jerry Brown has been following me around for years. When I was a youngster, when I was like 19, I was in the California Conservation Corps, and I started this search and rescue thing in San Diego. And so he came down to give us like a little award and stuff, and I thought he was really cool then. And then recently, a few years ago, I was working for a program, the Fisher Foundation in Oakland, and he was the mayor, and I went in to ask him if he could give us some funding, because, you know, we were getting people off the streets, and we were, you know, turning people around. And basically, the only money we were getting was like food stamps that we were getting to pay for the food.
Right.
And he was like, and he just made this big thing about how you guys got food stamps, you should feel that you're lucky. You know, and I was really shocked because, from years before when he was governor the last time, I actually thought he was a pretty nice guy. And then the second time I met him, and this time I really sat down and had a half-hour conversation with the guy, I just thought, what a punk.
Now, look, you're talking about our governor, the governor of the great state of California, you understand?
Yeah.
Yeah,
so, he's called the governor of punk.
Yeah, let me ask you one more question, Dan, while I'm here. What's the level of street performance activity and, like, craft sales and stuff on Telegraph Avenue? Is it pretty regular and pretty vigorous usually every day?
It's really died out. You know, I said this years ago, when they started getting rid of people, I said, you know, if you start running these people off, you're going to have to hire actors to play them. and that's basically where we are now, you know. I've actually had people come up and say, hey, can you help us get some people up here to, do some performing and stuff like that? And I'm like, no, I don't think so, because I don't want to have people that I know that are friends of mine and take my word for things come up here and get beat up by the police.
Right.
Has that happened recently? Are performers being beaten up, or ticketed?
They're not
up there?
The kind of performers that if it's not Sonny and Cher.
They're down here now.
Yeah, way
right.
Down,
that's what I heard.
Actually, I know that you have, according to this story in the Berkeley Daily Planet that I was referring to about, you know, the protest against. Well, let's see, how is it described? It says, let's see here. It talks about some street performers. Berkeley's Telegraph Avenue Saturday demonstration. It was small, but it rewrites Berkeley street politics, is what Ted Friedman writes in the Berkeley Daily Planet, which used to be given around Berkeley as a free newspaper and now is simply online.
Right.
It says, in a dueling megaphone cacophony last Saturday in Berkeley between Jesus Freaks on Hayes Street and Michael Delacour demonstrating outside Moe's Books, a new chapter in Berkeley street politics emerged. Delacour has called for the demo the preceding week to focus on beefs with such Berkeley business persons as Doris Moskowitz of Moe's and Craig Becker of the Cafe Mediterranean, calling them at a good place.
Becker?
Yeah.
Becker, yeah.
Yeah. Calling them at a good place to meet in, but saying it's profiting from a local community it doesn't support. Delacour denounced telly merchants who have blamed the park, People's Park, which is half a block away, for their declining revenues. 8 persons demonstrated. According to Delacour, a large solidarity demonstration at the UN Plaza in San Francisco in support of Egyptian dissidents may have cut his attendance. And it's an interesting story. I invite people to check it out, and I'll probably read more of it once we've ended our interview. This sounds like an unusual kind of protest, because I haven't heard of many of these happening in Berkeley. Is this likely to become more active? I mean, we used to do this down in Santa Cruz, too. For example, Bunny Shoes was the... We had a series of protests, I guess it was summer before last, 2009. We've had protests about, discrimination at restaurants. What kind of discrimination are homeless people and street performers or counterculture people facing?
If you don't look right in Berkeley, you're not going to use the bathroom anywhere, and you're not going to, be welcome in many places, and outside of the park itself.
And then the park actually does have a bathroom you can use, right?
Well, it has a bathroom, but I wouldn't use it.
Is there any street performance going on in the park at all?
We have shows that, different activist community people put on in the park. But as for street performers, it's really, you know, that's the reason that, you know, Michael Delacour, you know, is coming out to say something, because it's really dying on the vine over here.
No, bro.
You know, it's just, you know, people come to Telegraph to see, you know, because they hear about the fabled Telegraph and the musicians and the cool people. And, you know, when you beat the crap out of the cool people,
yeah,
for so long, they just go away and they go do something else where they're not going to get hassled as much.
Yeah.
And then these people that own business go, why is my business failing?
Well, your business is failing because
you got rid of the attraction. There's nothing here if there's not for those people.
It makes Santa Cruz sound like an artist colony by comparison, because we have many street performers down here, and although they have their own challenges day to day, anytime you go up and down the mall, you hear people playing guitar or playing drums or playing various things, and there are restrictions, and I'll grant you that, but at least...
Well, I'm going to have to come down and get a few of them, I guess.
Absolutely.
Divas, you should take so much more sunny view of the scene on Pacific Avenue than I do. In fact, most of the regular street performers have been driven away or died off, is what I found. At least that's what I get from, you know, the people I'm talking to. You find new people who show up, who start to play, or you find little family groups that are sort of tolerated by the police and who aren't there with regularity. But I hear a lot of, we have here in Santa Cruz, we have the so-called unreasonably disturbing noise ordinance, which is an extremely kind of peculiar ordinance, which I suppose it's supposed to deal with, I don't know, loud, you know, screechy sounds over a long period of time that are being made by someone. But the word music, for example, does not appear in the ordinance.
The point that I'm making, in a relatively small area, as Pacific Garden Mall is, on any given day, my observation is that you can find three or four guitar players or people singing or doing things. We'll go down there tonight, and there'll be people in front of Borders playing guitar and singing in groups of two
or
three.
They're like, John Denver's cool, but Tiny Tim is out.
Well, a lot of it is country and western, country, Americana, kind of what they call down
well,
here.
Well, there are some hardcore people who continue, like, Ricardo Lopez.
Well, we don't have the Trash Orchestra and things like that.
Who plays? Well, the Trash Orchestra is another issue entirely. That's a group that used to play at protests and has now, because of Wes Modes, who was convicted of walking in a parade on New Year's Eve by the city, he's abandoned the Trash Orchestra. He hasn't been doing that. He's doing other stuff that's less high profile. But I think there's a definite repression. Yeah, you know, on Pacific Avenue. It depends to some extent on whether you want to follow the order of the police officer of the moment. And what we have in Santa Cruz
right.
is you have a situation where if a private person complains about any musician downtown, the police
right.
officer will come up and essentially tell that person to move along. They won't tell them to quiet down, which is really what the ordinance says. They will tell them to move. That's what
right.
I generally found to be the case. And we've seen the drum circle. We have a Wednesday drum circle driven all over town, harassed, physically assaulted, all the way to its areas declared that it was in declared suddenly closed as parks.
Which is now, as of last night, back and more vigorous than ever was downtown.
No, it's not more vigorous. It's about one-fifth the size it used to be, and it's kind of strung out in a line along the levee, and it's you know...
Were you there, Charlie?
I was. I was there
you
yesterday.
You were there last night?
Not last night. I was there two nights ago. This is... last night was Wednesday night. I was there last night for a brief period of time. But I think, you know, I mean, it is true that some people will continue to play, and the police tried to drive them away 3 or 4 weeks ago, and they arrested one person, and we then publicized that heavily. It actually got into the media in an unusual fashion, and I think as a consequence of that kind of publicity, and maybe up in Berkeley you're having a similar situation. What would you say about that, Dan?
It's really hard to judge where the tipping point is and what the tipping point is, but we've gone over the tipping point a while back in Berkeley as when it comes to street musicians and just the entire flavor of Telegraph Avenue and the way things were when it was a real fun place to hang out.
What's the fate of People's Park? What's going on there?
Well, you know, People's Park is full of more people than ever. It's just that they're becoming increasingly more destitute and needy, because things like the Free Box that used to clothe people are no longer there, so people are dirtier.
How long has the Free Box been gone?
It's been a couple of years now. You know, I think the last time we attempted to put one in was like 6 months ago. But every time we try to do something, they would rather people come and just dump the clothes on the ground. And basically there's some clothes on the ground, and they come out and they throw those away in a locked dumpster as soon as they can.
This is the police you're talking about, or the UC or the Berkeley police?
Yeah, it's the UC police.
So, for a while, the free box operated, was that because the UC police were more lenient, or is that because people were more militant?
Because people were more militant. You know, there used to be, you know, I remember some years back in the early 90s, we had a measure, N and O, I think it was.
Yeah,
and there were so many people, which was, one of those sitting on the sidewalk ordinances.
It was the first one, the one I talked about that was...
Absolutely, first in the state,
actually, that got
passed
by initiative.
And so many people came out for that that they had to take the meeting out of the city council chambers and bring it over into the theater at the high school. And the whole theater was full of people, and the entire campus was full of people. People juggling and with torches. Now, if something three times worse goes on, and you can't get five people to the city council meeting.
Yeah.
You know, and people are, people are so worried about their own fingernails that are scraping down the cliffs that it seems like there's a lot of fight has been kicked out of people. You know, there's just a few of us old stalwarts that keep fighting, but it just seems like we lose a lot of people through attrition. People die.
Yeah. Dan, how many shelter beds do you have available, emergency shelter, each night in Berkeley?
Oh. I think there's, with Harrison House all together, I think there's like 120.
Uh-huh. And
yeah,
what do you estimate the unsheltered population to be any given night in Berkeley?
About 2,000.
Yeah?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it gets up to like 3,000 sometimes, if you count the people out in Albany and the waterfront.
Yeah, that's very close to the same ratio we have here. We have, any given night now with the armory open, about 146-odd beds, and... depending who you talk to, we've got a couple of thousand homeless or so.
In the city. Yeah.
Well, when it rains, a few years ago I got a rain shelter opened up here that opens up when it rains, and it's always packed, and it's always, whenever people come, or there are always people being turned away out into the cold.
Mm-hmm. And you just let people just walk up and get in and... there's any no requirement that they sign up ahead of time or they
No, this is just emergency rain and when it's raining or it's cold.
Yeah, hence the name, huh? We have a problem here with our emergency shelters are always so full, of course, and the armory, you have to sign up ahead of time. The armory, you have to go over to our homeless services center by 4 o'clock in the afternoon and take the only bus shuttle up there, so there are some restrictions and challenges even on the shelter space that we have available.
Big time.
Right. It's crazy. It's really crazy.
No question. I that's beyond the contestation, really.
You know, Berkeley is one of the few cities that has not quite the same law as we do, but... we have a law called the parking. I call it the parking lot and garages. Well, they call it the parking lot and garages trespass law. I call it the parking lot panic and the parking garage paranoia law, which makes it illegal to be in a parking lot at all unless you're either directly walking through, you're a city employee engaged in city business there.
They tried that here too.
And that's what I was saying. Berkeley is one of the few other cities that has something similar. Is that law still on the books? Is it being enforced? What's the story?
No, I don't think that one. That one didn't make it. They tried to do that one. That one didn't make it.
No, I think there is.
We counted that one with. Why don't we turn the parking garages into shelters when it's raining?
Well, that's what
they really got scared.
And Santa Cruz, that's
alone.
Well, that's what they would get scared because apparently they have a residual either conscience or fear of people who do have a conscience. In Santa Cruz, that was the very reason used to pass the law, that we had these unsightly, dirty, homeless, dangerous people hanging out in the garages that are trying to making it an unwelcoming environment. That our new mayor, Ryan Coonerty, was saying back in 2006, his employees at the Bookshop Santa Cruz were frightened to go to work because of the possibility that they just felt unsafe with these people, hiding in the, or sheltering themselves from the rain or being in and out of the cold in these garages. And then
for me, I see people in those creepy garages, and I'm like happy because I know there's somebody's going to be there if there is a creep down there.
That's what activist Becky Johnson was saying, that the more eyes on the street, the safer you really are.
Absolutely.
And that is it, now you say that, or is that because you're some sort of a partisan of the lower classes, or do you actually find that to be true?
Well, I just make it my part of my life to know people in my neighborhood and know people in my city, and whether they're poor or rich or on the streets or whatever, and if I need help from any of them, I know I can always reach out.
Is that because you know them, or because they just happen to be there?
Well, I'm a New Yorker. When I lived in New York, if I came downstairs and went out to my car and there was a guy on the curb, I always made sure that I, introduced myself and, hey, how you doing? And then if there was ever trouble, that's one of the people that would come to the rescue.
There you go. Absolutely.
You actually rubbed noses with the riffraff. I don't know whether we want to continue this kind of conversation. We're talking to Dan McMillan in Berkeley, because we're not, unfortunately, Dan, our broadcasting equipment is screwed up tonight, so you are not broadcasting, but we are streaming, so all your many fans in Tunisia and Egypt can hear you, but not...
Absolutely. I wish them the best and all the love.
Hey, has that had any impact in Berkeley? Are people out there on the streets, saying, right on, Tunisia, and, let's do it here in Berkeley? And that's probably not, from what you're saying.
People are starting to get pissed off, and, like I said... Just in the thing, when things go down, there's also tipping points in the other direction, And sometimes people say, hey, I've just been kicked around too much, and a lot of people feel the same way. It was just like when I had the sleep out on this island out there. Hundreds of people showed up. We had Country Joe McDonald doing a concert.
When was this?
It was crazy, but. But it was just because people all felt the same way. They all were terrorized by the same thing.
This is in Arneyville that happened last year, or
yeah, this was in May and then June
of this of 2010.
Right.
Oh, Country Joe still around town?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. He's really a great guy. He always helps me out.
So, what's the next event coming up in Berkeley? If the people who are maybe travelers might want to go to that you think is worth looking in on.
I know Michael Delacour has something going on in, I think this weekend, Saturday, in front of the Bank of America on Shattuck. They're doing something about, the banks. I don't know exactly what that is at this point, but I'm going to check it out
myself. Probably people can find out by going to indiebay.org/eastbay. Is that one place to go?
Yeah, I'm sure.
That's Indie Bay and East Bay up there. It's similar to our Santa Cruz Indie Media. It's Indie Media for... East Bay. We've been talking with Dan McMillan. Dan, is there anything more you want to say before we run off?
No, thanks for talking. It was great talking to you.
Hey, yeah, one last thing, Dan. You have a police review commission up there. What's going on with that? There's been some. We had ours. Ours was dismantled in 2003, but I've heard a lot of criticism of yours. Is anything happening with that police review commission?
No, I think they dismantled it, and then they were supposed to put it back together, but I haven't heard anything about it.
I think they do have it, but I think it's probably been defunded a lot up in Berkeley. But I know ours is gone. So
it's like it's turned into some like secret thing.
I think there was a decision in 2006 that essentially protected police employees and stopped police review commissions, either statewide, I think it's statewide, from revealing the results of investigations by independent bodies. It's a really grotesque decision. Anyway,
and Dan,
considering the last time they had a big thing at the Police Review Commission, they found that the police here took 2 years' worth of drugs out of the drug locker, and that this cop was selling them on the streets of Berkeley.
That's free enterprise.
That's pretty bad. And that was the last big thing they had with the Police Review Commission. And I haven't heard anything since. They wanted to shut that stuff up. But, I was really tripping out because I'd be cruising through town, I'd see these guys in their police cars, and they're all sweating bullets, and I got these beady eyes, and I've seen enough people on drugs over the years to know what one looks like, and I go, these guys look like they're tweaking, and they were.
Well, police
and
officers
thought
are
I was
relaxed
crazy at the time.
Too.
I go, I don't bet
you
anything these guys are tweaking, and later on it came out that they all were tweaking.
Well, you're criticizing your police force again. Steve had a comment or a question.
No, I was just thinking, if Dan, you ever want to relocate down here to Santa Cruz, I could certainly use an extra vote in the next city council election.
Amen.
I'll come down and give you 2 votes.
All right. Vote early and vote often, my friend.
Hey, thank you. Thank you, Dan.
All right, thanks. Have a good night.
Take care.
And that was Dan McMillan up in Berkeley. You can learn more about what's happening in Berkeley. I guess I'll finish a little bit about this article before we leave the subject. This is about a demonstration that was in front of the Med, which is a cafe in Berkeley, kind of famous as a meeting place right across from what was Cody's Books. It's been closed down, but Moe's Books is still remaining. Shakespeare's Books is on the corner. There are three big bookstores in this one block on Telegraph Avenue, four blocks from the campus between Haste and Bancroft? No, not Bancroft, another street. Dwight Way, I believe it was. So this was a protest by homeless people concerned about anti-homeless merchants who are bad-mouthing People's Park, which is a public space which is open to the community but has over the years been defended by a variety of groups in the community, but also for homeless people particularly, as a space to be, although I think it's still illegal to be in the park after dark, or it's illegal to sleep in the park. That used to be these are laws that Santa Cruz similarly has, even though there's no legal places for people to sleep anyway. It's another one of these insane, if you're bothering, the very possibility of bothering middle-class people who are uptight, then we're not going to allow you to even live, or exist or engage in normal human behaviors. Eight persons demonstrated, again, in front of these stores. Ann Fagan Ginger, 85, actually I've had on the show, a well-known East Bay Civil Liberties attorney, opened the event. Although her eyesight has failed, she saw into the hearts of passersby, urging them to see how U.S. imperialism in the Middle East was about to ruin their lives. Sorry. And it's interesting, we too, when we did protests in Santa Cruz against discrimination by officials and by businesses around homeless issues, also raised the issues of foreign intervention abroad, because there's a connection between these both in terms of the obvious financial huge amounts of money being given to foreign adventures while the domestic economy is being starved, but also the economy creates a huge number, the wars create a huge number of homeless veterans who are, without services, who are disparaged, despised, ignored, and left, to rot, having been used by the military. Now, I, on occasion, have disparaged veterans myself in the sense to demystify them. I think veterans are killers who haven't been defending the country at all. They've been bamboozled by propaganda or by the economic necessities into joining foreign occupation forces that are oppressing people abroad. And they shouldn't be glorified. But that doesn't mean that as people, once they've returned and have stopped doing those activities, they shouldn't be treated with some dignity, some respect, and some caring. And they often, because they're a significant percentage of the homeless population nationally. I'm not quite sure what their percentage is locally. That's your job, Steve, to check out the number of vets who are here, a local, what percentage of the homeless population. You'll get right on that. These issues are often merged. So we do anti-homeless, we called it the war, two wars, vigil against two wars back in 2003 when we fought the Iraqi war and the war on the poor. And according to this, they're doing something similar. Moe's recently mounted, this is the bookstore, mounted a nostalgic set of handsomely mounted 60s demonstration photos of Telegraph Avenue when the whole world was watching. One of these photo pictures, a demo crowd massed in front of Moe's, the world-famous emporium of rare and used books. And another of these topsy-turvy significations with which history surprises itself, the current demo is against Moe's. That's as in against. How could the flip be flopping that way? Well, obviously what's happening is you have people kind of cashing in on the cachet of the 60s to commercially sell it, but who actually are running the other way from it. And Steve here does a lone protest every Saturday. He is between the hours of 1 and 2 in the afternoon, or at least this was the case last Saturday.
And it will be this Saturday. And every Saturday until the troops come home. Simple as that.
So what are you going to be doing?
My promise to America.
You're going to have a little sign that you're holding up?
You saw my sign last
I
Saturday.
I helped you darken
me,
your sign.
Yes, indeed. Make it more visible. That was your contribution.
Indeed. My four-minute contribution.
Wasn't gone unnoticed. So.
All right. Well, thank you, Steve. And for those who want to join him, he can. He will be at the town clock between 1 and 2 with a sign. He refuses to put out emails on the subject, though. In fact, I think other supporters may be rounding up the troops for you, Steve. for the next wave of you know, I think actually with all this ferment, I guess it's the 10 million person funeral that's supposed to be happening tomorrow in Cairo.
Now, did you hear any updates? Now, what I heard
maybe
this morning was that
action for you.
Was Hosni Mubarak had agreed to step down. He was supposed to step down at noon, and then I heard that.
No. He angered the crowd. This is what I heard as I drove over here.
Okay.
The crowd of a million people or a million and a half people by saying that he would be staying at least until September and he wouldn't be running again for office, and that he had partially transferred authority to his man with the CIA, Suleiman, who is the vice president. Mm-hmm. Suleiman is sort of there's a lot of actually even mainstream media is covering Suleiman's very dark history. They're all part of the Mubarak machine over there. But what's important is not, you know, I mean, what's interesting is that this mass number of people that is continuing to press the issue, continue to camp out there. It's already morning, I think, in Egypt now. It's February 11th over there now. You know, they're starting their huge 10 million, largest funeral in the world, funeral tomorrow for this journalist that got killed. But this kind of people power... I don't know. It's maybe not accurate to say it began with one person burning himself or one person, you know, the April 6th movement. Mm-hmm. That.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. No less a commentarian than Travis T. Hipp from KPIG.
Uh-oh.
On his this morning, he was talking about that the generation of the 60s, almost to a person, many of them were involved in large mass demonstrations, and it's something that this most recent generation hasn't been involved with at all. And we've kind of lost that experience of large mass, you know, unified demonstrations for some reason. And since the 60s and 70s, or you know, anti-war activities in Vietnam and that kind of thing, people just haven't really had the experience of doing that.
Well, in the 80s, there was a huge anti-nuclear movement in the early 80s, and in the 90s in Santa Cruz, we had wall-to-wall
but
people.
But not to the scale that I'm talking about,
well,
tens of hundreds of thousands of people.
Well, that's true.
And that's what he's talking about.
However, there were massive numbers of people.
Well, that's not what I'm
talking
about. Steve,
there were massive numbers of people in 1990 on the streets blocking freeways when the first Iraqi war happened. Huge numbers. And that, I mean, I think we can even say, well, that 20 years ago, number has not been replicated. I mean, that it happened once again with Rodney King. During the Rodney King verdict in 92, the freeways were blocked here by hundreds, if not thousands, of people. And then we had this big kind of the last gasp wasn't even that. It was a sort of a once, oh, please, President Bush, don't go to war, when we had a huge peaceful march of 6,000 people, and then that was it.
Yeah.
And it was all over. There's nothing for the last 8 years.
Well, certainly not his
really.
Point, but... That's your opinion.
Well, I won't dignify that with a response at this time. Anyway, I hope we can do the kind of... I think small protests like yours and like this 8-person protest on Telegraph Avenue are significant.
Women in Black.
Women in Black every Friday?
Friday from 5 to 6, and right in front of O'Neill's at the corner of Pacific, and that's Cooper.
And Huff used to hold quite regular protests at the bookshop Santa Cruz.
And Huff, that would be...
Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom.
Yes, sir. And we are vigorously, actively recruiting volunteers and interns.
Yes, we are.
Yeah.
I mean, those people should give a call to 423-HUFF, 423-4833. I actually had something I was going to play, but before I do, let's let Laura Nero sing us a little song again before we disappear into the distance.
Can you serve it? Can you pick me? Whoa, can you serve it? Can you pick me? Come on, come on. Yellow honey, sassafras, and moonshine.
And that, of course, was Stone Soul Picnic by Laura Nero. You turn to Free Radio, 101.1 FM. Actually, it's freakradio.org and probably the archives of freakradio.org because we are having some broadcasting problems. In the studio with me is Steve Plaich. I'm Robert Norris. And the phone number here, in case you're listening to the stream and you want to call in with comments or thoughts, is 427-3772. I've got here a thing that I want to read. Ron Paul, Ralph Nader agree on Progressive Libertarian Alliance. In this corner, a libertarian Tea Party hero who ran several campaigns as a candidate for U.S. president on the Republican ticket. And in that corner, a progressive icon of the left who also ran several campaigns for the U.S. presidency but on the Green Party ticket. One might think the two men seemingly ideologically opposed to one another would rather argue than help one another. However, on Wednesdays, and this we're talking of a Wednesday in January, broadcast of Freedom Watch on the Fox Business Channel, Judge Napolitano sat down for an amiable...
It's got to be Jean Napolitano. She's the head of Homeland Security?
Don't know. It says judge here.
Oh, really?
Okay. Yeah, I don't know. For an amiable interview with Representative Ron Paul, Republican of Texas, and Ralph Nader to discuss a progressive libertarian alliance in the 112th session of respective chambers in Congress. Nader isn't in Congress, but Ron Paul, of course, is a long old-timer in Congress who's opposed all the foreign wars from the beginning, I think, or at least... as far as long as I've heard. Nader, who has recently called this coalition the most exciting new political dynamic in the U.S. today, explained that it works well because both groups stand against corporatists who believe government should be run in the interests of corporations. I believe in coalitions, Representative Paul echoed, that they talk about we need more bipartisanship, and I say we have too much bipartisanship because the bipartisanship we have here in Washington endorses corporatism. Paul added that he agreed with Nader on a host of issues, such as cutting the U.S. military's budget, ending undeclared U.S. wars overseas, restoring civil liberties and civil rights by dumping the Patriot Act, and withdrawing from the NAFTA and World Trade Organization agreements. I think we should come together and work together, and I think we can, he said, noting that the coalition had previously worked on deficit financing solutions. Representative Paul and Senator Bernie Sanders, independent of Vermont, the most conservative and most liberal members of their respective chambers, joined forces last session to fight for an audit of the Federal Reserve, a private institution that handles America's monetary policy, which Nader explained is under no legal control of Congress. The banks fund the Fed, Nader said. It doesn't go through the congressional appropriations process as it should under our Constitution. Paul is the current chairman of a congressional subcommittee that would conduct oversight on the U.S. Federal Reserve Bank. He explained, however, that he would not have the subpoena power to force Tom Geithner, U.S. Treasury Secretary, and Ben Bernanke, the chairman of the Federal Reserve, to testify under oath about the Fed's policies. That power is in the hands of the chairman of the full committee, he said. But that doesn't mean we'll go lightly on digging up this for this information because Ralph is absolutely right on this thing, Paul said. When asked, Nader stopped short of endorsing a full repeal of the Federal Reserve. The Fed, whatever it does, should be a cabinet-level accountable institution, he proposed instead. Paul also reiterated his stance that spending on overseas bases in U.S. military budget should be that the U.S. military's budget should be cut and that U.S. troops should be brought home. And here's a video of these two guys chatting.
Mm-hmm. Tonight on Freedom Watch, a very special event.
We're having a little problem here. Hang on. Make sure my... Aha. Okay. And now, hopefully, the interview. This is radio at its best. Are you ready?
Just good radio.
Libertarian and Tea Party hero Ron Paul and icon of the left Ralph Nader. Think they couldn't disagree? Think again. Congressman Paul, Mr. Nader are with us now in a rare interview. Congressman Paul is the author of End the Fed. Ralph Nader is the author of Only the Super Rich Can Save Us. Gentlemen, welcome to Freedom Watch.
Thank you.
Ralph, to you first. You have recently said that Congressman Paul and the Tea Party Republicans are different than the other Republicans in the Congress. What do you mean by that?
To the extent that they are genuine libertarian conservatives and not corporatists, corporatists believe in corporate government, they are great allies with many liberals and progressives to challenge the bloated, wasteful military budget, to challenge undeclared wars overseas, to challenge hundreds of billions of dollars in corporate welfare, handouts, giveaways, bailouts, to challenge the invasiveness of our civil liberties and civil rights by the notorious Patriot Act, to challenge the sovereignty-shredding, job-destroying NAFTA and World Trade Organization agreements, and also to the first victory will be a powerful whistleblower bill that libertarian conservatives and liberals and progressives in the Congress almost got through last year to let government employees ethically blow the whistle on corporate rapaciousness and contracts and government misdeeds.
Congressman,
just think of that agenda for a dynamic political force.
All right, Ralph, you have given enough topics there for us to talk for 2 hours. We only have about 10 minutes. And you're both friends of mine, and we both have chatted about these issues. But Congressman Paul, almost everything that Ralph Nader just said, you could have said, and you have said. Is this a coalition of the leading libertarian in the Congress and one of the leading progressives in American culture today?
Well, you know, I believe in coalitions. You know, they always talk about we need more bipartisanship. And I say we have too much bipartisanship because the bipartisanship here in Washington endorses corporatism, which Ralph and I disapprove of. But, you know, coalitions are different. Ralph and I do have some disagreements, but that list he just made, I agree with him on that. So I think we should come together and work together, and I think we can. Matter of fact, we had a little project during the last campaign where I got progressives and libertarians and conservatives together, and we actually had an agreement that we shouldn't be having deficit financing. We didn't agree on where to spend and who to tax and all that, but we had an agreement that, you know, these runaway deficits are horrible for us, and, of course, we even mentioned the and we got an agreement. So I think there's a lot of room for progressives and libertarian conservatives to work together.
Ralph, Congressman Paul, of course, has been the leading member of Congress on auditing the Fed and on ending the Fed. You probably support him on both of those, don't you?
Well, the Fed is completely out of control. It's not under any legal controls that Congress can really enforce. I mean, look at the bailouts over the weekend. Last year and a half, a little over a year ago, on Citigroup, $350 billion bailout in secret. The banks fund the Fed. It doesn't go through the congressional appropriations process, as it should under our Constitution. It needs an audit, and I think Congressman Paul is teaming up with hyper-progressive Senator Sanders to bring the Fed into openness and greater accountability. So that's another political dynamic that can increase in force and power in Congress.
All right, Congressman Paul, since the last time we talked about this, there's been a change, and that is the new Congress has come in. The Republicans are numerically superior in the House, and as a result of this, you are chair of a subcommittee of the House, one of whose jobs is to monitor the Fed. Question, will you succeed in serving subpoenas on Ben Bernanke to show up and have a chat with you under oath and to bring his ledger sheets with him? And will he comply with those subpoenas? And if he does do that, can Ralph Nader sit in the front row?
Well, I'll tell you what, I've been doing some checking, and I've been informed that for the Federal Reserve Board Chairman and Secretary of Treasury and officials in the Cabinet go to the full committee. So I will not have that authority, but I may be able to do somebody that is not the full chairman of the committee. But if he does, it'll have to come from the chairman of the committee. But that doesn't mean that we'll go lightly on digging up for this information, because Ralph is absolutely right on this thing. Actually, the Federal Reserve can have a bigger budget than the Congress. I mean, they can spend $3-4 trillion in a year, and then they don't want us to tell us. Now, one thing I did get a gentleman's agreement with on many members on the Banking Committee already is I made a suggestion. I said, why don't we ask the Fed what they're going to do if they're going to spend a certain amount of money, get approval from the Congress. If they plan to give $10 billion out, why should they do that without congressional approval? It's totally out of control. It was never meant to be, and it was never the founders' intention to have a system that we have today.
Last question on the Fed, and then I want to change subjects. Ralph, would progressives support a repeal of the Federal Reserve Act of 1913, stated differently, literally, legally, ending the Fed?
Well, I can't speak for all of them, but clearly, in my judgment, the Fed should be a whatever it does, should be a cabinet-level accountable institution. Right now, it's a private bank government inside the federal government, funded by fees from the banks and thumbing its nose at Congress. But its worst nightmare is Congressman Ron Paul, who now is head of the subcommittee overseeing the Fed. Watch for the fireworks.
All right. Let's switch gears and talk about fireworks. Congressman Paul, if we ended our military ventures in Iraq and Afghanistan tomorrow, could that not provide us the substantial and deep budget cuts that we need to prevent further borrowing and perhaps to spend less than we actually take in tax dollars?
Absolutely. This, and I think it's the easiest place to cut. I mean, do we as libertarians might not approve of some of these medical programs, but is that the place to start, or should it be overseas spending? And should we have a stronger national defense by bringing our troops home? And I say that is the place to go. We should cut from overseas and bring the troops home. And I think the world would be more at peace. I was complaining today, they had questions about China. I said, they're getting to be good capitalists. They work hard, they save money, and they buy up resources. What do? We send our troops out and say we're protecting our oil in the Middle East and we're draining our resources. That does contribute significantly to the bankruptcy. All wars are fought with inflation, destruction of the money, which is the reason we have unemployment today.
Ralph, I know how you feel. I know how you feel about the wars, Ralph. I want to switch gears a little bit.
Yeah, just to punctuate, $30 million an hour, 24 hours a day we're spending on those two wars. $30 million an hour.
Ralph, WikiLeaks, is it a good thing for mature people in a mature democracy to know what their government is up to, let the chips fall where they may?
Of course, information is the currency of democracy. And without information, you don't know what the government is doing. You don't know how to check it. You don't know how to improve it. And as Congressman Ron Paul said memorably a few days ago, the Bush-Cheney administration lied their way to the Iraq war. And lying is covering up the truth, and lying is secrecy. And the same is true for millions of Americans being subjected to surveillance in violation of federal law, which is a five-year felony. Here they're worried about WikiLeaks when we've gotten into war because of secrecy and cover-ups, illegal wars. And we are putting Americans under unconstitutional surveillance.
Got it.
All
right. You two have been agreeing on a lot. Now, the hot topic of the day on which I suspect you disagree. Well, maybe I can find some common ground. I think you are both in favor of repealing the health care law. Congressman Paul, because he wants the free market to address health care. Mr. Nader, because he wants universal health care paid for by the government, which this legislation doesn't accomplish. Ralph, to you first. Health care. If you were in the Congress today, would you vote to repeal it?
Yes, in favor of single payer. Full Medicare for all with free choice of doctor and hospital by everybody. Everybody in, nobody out. The insurance companies have defaulted. They've demonstrated they cannot be trusted in terms of establishing a pay-or-die or pay-or-get-sick system, which is costing 45,000 American lives a year who cannot get insurance to get diagnosed and treated.
Congressman I suspect you don't agree with anything Ralph just said. You have the last word.
Well, we both oppose the corporatism that's involved in medicine, and that's one thing we'd agree on. But no, I disagree with the delivery of health care by the government. Anytime the government delivers a service, the cost goes up and the quality goes down, and whether it's education or whether it's medical care. So I want medical care delivered more like cell phones and TVs and computers, because there's the least amount of regulation, the prices keep dropping, and poor people end up with TVs and cell phones. That's what would happen with services, too, and would maintain the services.
Congressman Ron Paul, Ralph Nader, thank you for joining us on Freedom Watch.
And that was the Right-Left Alliance. You can check that out. Just if you Google for Nader and Ron Paul, you'll probably come up with something similar there. You're tuned to Free Radio. I'm going to play a little bit more of the Linda LeMaster colloquies in the corridors of the courthouse, where we talk about a bit about the security system that apparently You want to say something there, Steve?
No, not at all. Just observing.
I thought you were making some frantic motions.
No, not at all.
Get your hand out of your pants, Steve. But this is a decent studio here. God's
we're streaming live here.
Just kidding, of course.
It's just good radio.
It's exciting. It's arousing radio,
yes,
really, in many ways.
Edge. Yes, it is.
Indeed.
We're reaching a tipping point, though.
We're kind of we won't get into that.
A tipping point.
Indeed, a tipping point.
But anyway, Linda's always interesting to listen to.
Let's hear Linda. Yeah.
Out the exit directly, but there is a man in a brown outfit, dare we call him a brown shirt, with a badge and a gun.
More of a khaki, greenish brown.
It is. It's kind
of an American
a green
military
shirt,
than
maybe a
Italian military.
What do we call that? A sort of a mauve shirt? I don't know.
Tan.
Sort of, not really. Tan. Maybe tan.
It's
tannish green. And he's sitting there, presumably making sure that no one enters the exit. Here, other than possibly the privileged people, the judges.
With his iPhone.
And he does have an iPhone,
and he has a heater.
He also has a heater, apparently.
And he told me I couldn't take pictures in the court. I told him thanks anyway. I knew that.
And the hallway,
no,
you can't.
He's not just watching the door. He's watching.
Wait a minute. He told you couldn't take pictures in the hallway or
no,
in the court?
No. I tried to take a picture Ed as he went in.
Right.
And the guy must have noticed. This deputy must have noticed.
Right.
So I backed up and let everybody go in, and I was almost last. And he gets up and says, you know, you can't take pictures in there, meaning in the courtroom.
Right.
I said, yeah, thanks.
Well, it's interesting because I know in Department 4, which is a couple doors down here about a number of months ago, maybe last year sometime, it must have been, Becky Johnson was taking photos of people who were outside, I think part of the horrendous number of people who were being dragged in by the city attorney and subpoenaed in to testify against homeless musicians Anna Richardson and Miguel de Leon, who they were attempting to get an unprecedented civil injunction against, which would ban them from sleeping in the downtown area after 11 o'clock at night. Actually, they wanted to convict them on that charge. I'm not quite sure actually if it was a conviction trial or was an attempt to make the injunction a permanent one, but it was one of those two. She attempted to take photos, you may remember, and she was instructed not only by the bailiff, but by the judge that was illegal behavior and that she would be held to task. And she'd better go get her press credentials by cracky, as if that would make much difference. But do you remember that?
Yes, I do. And I was surprised, Becky pointed this out shortly after that incident, that the judge imputed that the hallway here is part of his courtroom. I wonder how the other judges feel about that.
An example of the hyper-security paranoia kind of constriction of the public space that happens particularly around courts, but this was something I'd never seen before. I talked about it on the radio, I think, about 6 months ago. Becky Johnson, an activist, writer, photographer, and defendant recently in the Sinister Singing case, she sung homeless songs downtown. She was also taking pictures outside the courtroom of people who were the government witnesses brought in, trooped in to testify against this homeless couple that they were sleeping downtown at different places. And they complained that she was taking pictures and that she shouldn't be taking pictures. But, of course, in a public place, there's no expectation of privacy. And therefore, it's also newsworthy that the government, the city attorney and the city and the city manager and the city council, for that matter, are spending so much money to harass two homeless musicians, tens of thousands of dollars. There were 23 different witnesses that were scheduled to testify against Anna Richardson and Miguel de Leon. And Becky wanted to take photos, and she was told not to take photos or she would be essentially held to some kind of criminal charge, which, of course, there isn't any criminal charge for doing that. The judge, however, directed he would find her, and I'm not quite sure how he could find her in contempt if she were in the hallways. But we've had similar kinds of problems when we distribute jury nullification literature around the courthouse. And my response to this kind of stuff is to keep doing it. Jury nullification literature is literature that says the jury has the right to decide not only whether the person is factually guilty or innocent based simply upon the little formula the judge and the DA give you and the jury instructions that are given, but upon whether they think the prosecution is fair, the law is just, things seem on the up and up. And the jury cannot, in fact, be challenged for anything it does unless it is there's some kind of tampering that goes on. But if you don't have to explain if you're a jury member why you make your decision, you can make a decision and you can decide whether the law itself is valid. So that often in Vietnam War cases, marijuana cases, cases involving homeless protesters, jurors would make a decision based upon the justice of the verdict. The justice of the prosecution, not simply upon whether they were sleeping at night or not and whether that's technically illegal. Hi, you're on Free Radio. I hope you can hear me, but I think you can't. And I don't know quite why you can't, but hopefully we'll learn soon. You need to do is call back on the other line, 469-3119. Okay. And hopefully we'll be able to get that caller in on the next 3 minutes before we have to leave the scene, because Uncle Dennis and from the Cream of the Dregs will be coming in. And here is our man calling in. Hi, you're on Free Radio, hopefully.
Yeah, it's me again.
Hi there.
Well, you know, if the photography gets to the point where it's intimidating these people, essentially you have a captive audience there of witnesses waiting outside the doorway for their turn to come in and testify. And if when they're constrained and they have to sit there and then somebody's trying to photograph them, that might be a little intrusive. I might not be happy if I were in that situation.
I understand. The fact of the matter is, though, that I think there's a public interest in taking photos of people who are, you know, being hauled in by the government to harass other people. I mean, I think it has a public interest function. I also think that when you're in a public place, even if it's uncomfortable, you really have no choice about that kind of thing. But Steve Plaich is a legal eagle. Steve, what's your thought about this? Steve's looking a little bewildered, perhaps a little tired. Steve, do you have any comments for our caller?
Well, I think his point in certain respects is well taken, you know, and I think mm-hmm. your response is equally measured. You know, it's a difficult situation. You know, you balance freedom of speech, freedom of expression. On the other hand, the people are there. They're being compelled to testify. They may, in certain terms, be in a place where they don't want to be, so they should be photographed. Who knows?
So, well, at least you got a neutral party there, caller. Any other thoughts?
Well, yeah, I've been thinking about this for a week or so since you had Scott Galloway on about a week ago. When you were interviewing him, he was telling the story about some young people at the Episcopal Church, and I think I heard this story previously, but it was being discussed how there was some older woman, as I recall, that approached some young men or boys or whoever they were, and there was some kind of an altercation, and I don't remember exactly what happened, you know, but I guess there was some physical thing that happened there. And when you were talking to Scott, you were kind of making the point that this kid was provoked, and therefore he had a right to use physical violence. That was the implication.
No,
that was what I got.
Yeah, let me clarify that. I mean,
Scott was trying to disagree with you. I mean, he was actually being very mild. But he was
right.
not agreeing with your point of view. And I know that if it was a policeman that did that, you would be all over it.
We got to go back.
You'd be talking about it for months.
Caller,
you'd be talking about it for years.
Caller, we got to go back because, see, this actual incident I've heard described from, at least one other person, Renee Curry, in great detail. And we've talked about this the woman who was involved in this incident. And she has been – the incident was differently described. I don't think anyone has a right to respond with physical violence generally to situations unless they're defending themselves.
Okay, good. I agree.
And that was, in essence, what was described by Renee Curry when she was on. And you can go back to this interview as I recollect it. And we're talking, by the way, about an incident that happened at the Calvary Episcopal Church and why the pretext being used by Cynthia Matthews and other conservatives to try to shut down the homeless meal on Monday. This was a woman who didn't like homeless people on the lawn, and she was reportedly harassing the homeless people and challenging them. And why are you here? What are you doing? And the guy was reportedly saying, according to Renee Curry, "Get away from me! Get away from me!" And finally, he was provoked into standing up and saying, "Get the hell away from me!" Something to that effect. And who knows? Maybe he touched her. I don't know. But the fact was, it was differently described by Curry than by Scott. And Scott wasn't a witness, I don't think. I mean, I don't even know if Renee was a witness. So it's really questionable. I know that when I talk to Scott informally, I talk to Father Joel and Renee informally, I get the impression that this was not a woman who is particularly, shall we say, I don't know if it's credible because I haven't ever talked. Her name is Margaret, and I've never talked to her, and I don't really know who she is. Anyway, I think you're right. You know, self-defense is you know, people
well,
have
even
right.
Self-defense is very complicated. I mean, yeah. When you start getting into what was self-defense, if
right.
somebody comes up to you and tries to hit you in the face,
yeah,
and
but
you,
see,
you,
that
you,
wasn't
you,
the issue. The real issue to me was you know, it seemed like this was being cooked up. But I understand your point. I mean, I do not want to be seen as a person who says, yeah, it's okay to shove people around or push them around or
threaten
them.
Yeah, that's kind of the way it sounded to me, because you were saying he had been provoked. And
except
that was
some for kind Ryan Coonerty. I have the right to shove him around all I want. Actually, just kidding about that.
Good, Dennis.
Anyway, thank you for calling. I'm afraid that the infamous Uncle Dennis has arrived with his plethora of tapes, records, beer bottles.
Matthews,
I don't know what the guy's got,
Do you think Cynthia Matthews
of... orange juice.
Do you think Cynthia Matthews abused her office by writing that letter on city letterhead?
Yes. Unless there was some official investigation by the city council about this issue, or unless it was open to some kind of public dialogue, yes, I think she abused it.
But on the other hand, if the city council didn't stand up and say, wait a minute, you don't have a right to do this, then I guess it was okay.
Well, I think we, the public, have a right to say, what are you doing putting this on? You're supposed to represent us. Do we have any opportunity to say anything about this? So my problem, though, is I'm out of time, caller. Perhaps we could bring this in, you know, on Sunday when I come back at perhaps 9:30 in the morning.
Okay. Have a good few days.
Hey, you too, man.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And that's it for Bathrop Spears Broadsides. Coming into the studio now, a man who isn't as well as he could be, but he's still here. He's still carrying on. He's going to bring you the music that you know and love and the ale that you'd like to drink. It's Uncle Dennis D.B.
No ale tonight.
No ale. It's what ails him, I guess. It's orange
I'm
juice.
Ailing, so I brought tangerine juice.
He brought, now, if you can guess the brand of the tangerine juice, perhaps he'll hoist a bottle with you. You never can tell.
From the cream?
To the dregs. That's it for Bathrop Spears Broadsides. Thanks for being with me on this edition, of Bathrop Spears Broadsides. And I'll be back on Sunday. And Steve Plaich says he's running for city council. We're waiting for a disc here before we sign off. I'm signing off.